Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
This week, a criminal was apprehended and brought to justice. The Golden State Killer committed 13 murders and more than 50 rapes, over 100 burglaries in California from about 1974 to 1986. For 42 years, police tried to solve these crimes. Paul Holes is an investigator for the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office, and he devoted most of his professional life to trying to solve the crime. 3 weeks ago, as Paul Holes was preparing to retire, 72-year-old John Joseph D'Angelo was named the Golden State Killer. He was arrested this week. D'Angelo himself was a former police officer. And joining us now is Paul Holes, retired Paul Holes, one of the men instrumental in solving this crime. Hi, Paul. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Hi, Sarah. How are you doing?
Good. And I know you've been busy. You've been all over the place talking about this. And I first want to say congratulations. What are the adjectives that describe how you feel after pursuing somebody, trying to figure out who they are, trying to get to the bottom of this, and now having this happen? What do you feel like?
You know, after 24 years of really just hunting for this guy, it's just surreal. I think I'm more numb than anything, and I really haven't had a chance to even just sit back and think about it. But it is a very satisfying feeling to see him in the interview room just looking like a defeated man.
Can you just briefly tell our listeners, who may not be as familiar with the crimes because we're here in Chicago as you might be in California, what was his M.O., what did he do, and how did it progress over the years?
Well, initially in 1974, Visalia, California, which is down near Fresno, California, had a series of burglaries. These were fetish burglaries. This guy was breaking into houses. He was going into women's drawers and pulling out their undergarments and just kind of throwing them around. And he would steal odd items like blue chip stamps and piggy banks. At one point, he attempts to abduct a 16-year-old girl out of her house, and while she's fighting with him outside, her father, Claude Snelling, tries to come to her rescue, and the ransacker shoots and kills Claude Snelling. A little bit later in the series, an officer, Roger McGowan, comes face-to-face with the ransacker, and the ransacker shoots at Officer McGowan, actually striking his flashlight, but is able to escape. He disappears from Visalia. About 6 months later, we have our first attack in Sacramento, June 1976, and after a handful of attacks, he becomes known as the East Area Rapist. And in this situation, he's going inside houses, typically in the middle of the night. For the first 15 attacks, he's only attacking when there are females present, and sometimes their kids are present, and he would tie the female up on her bed, go through the house and steal certain items and jewelry and cash, and then come back and sexually assault her. He always had a mask on, he always had gloves on, and he'd have a weapon such as a knife. Starting with the 16th attack, he starts attacking when there's a male present. And this is where he starts escalating, in that he comes in, the couple is asleep in their bed, he'll wake them up. As soon as they wake up and are completely disoriented, he's shining a flashlight in their eyes. He's still wearing a mask, he's still wearing gloves, but he always had a gun when there was a man present. And through clenched teeth, he would tell the couple, "Do what I say or I'll kill you. I'll blow your brains all over the walls." At this point, he would make the man lay face down on the bed and then toss shoelaces to the female. And now the female is having to tie up her husband or boyfriend. Once the man is tied up, then the rapist would go and tie the female up, go throughout the house, take a few items, and then come back with dishes or similar objects and put them on the male's back as an alarm system. And basically tell the guy, if I hear these, she's dead, or I'll kill everything in this house, referring to the children. He then would separate the female out to the family room and sexually assault her. He proceeded to do this style of attack 50 times in Northern California and then disappeared mid-1979. unbeknownst to the original investigators, he went down to Southern California and started killing people. In total, down in Southern California, you have 6 homicide cases where you have 10 people killed. And his last attack was May 5th, 1986, and then he just disappeared, and we have no other attacks after that.
I want to talk a little bit about the reasons why he may have stopped, but I want to ask you, just point blank, are you absolutely, positively certain that we have the right man here?
I am 100% absolutely certain. You know, first you have to recognize this offender left his DNA all over the state of California during the sexual assaults and homicides. We actually have 3 cases in Northern California in which DNA was preserved even though the statute of limitations had run out. That DNA matched the DNA from 5 of the 6 homicide cases where they actually had DNA. And this DNA has been collected at different crime scenes by different personnel, analyzed by different laboratories, and over the decades using different technologies, and it's always coming back to being from the same offender. When Mr. D'Angelo's DNA was collected, it 100% matched the DNA from the cases.
We just have about a minute before I have to take a break, but the interesting part to me about this is how the investigators use these DNA-type websites to try to find the killer. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, very briefly, is we had to generate a DNA profile compatible with searching the GEDmatch website, which is an open-source public database. So anybody who puts their DNA profile into that website has to opt in to make their profile public so the other public profiles can be searched against it. So we uploaded the Golden State Killer's DNA into that website and then got a list of our top matches. And it's not just one match, but it's many matches. And all these matches were on the order of a third cousin, fourth cousin, or even further out. And all I'm able to see is the amount of DNA that is matched. For example, the top match would be something like on the order of 63.5 units of DNA. And then if the person chose to put their real name and their real email in there, I can identify that person. And this person isn't under suspicion at all, but they're a beginning point to create a family lineage. And what I'm trying to do is trying to find multiple people who share DNA with the Golden State Killer and find a common ancestor. And once I do that, that common ancestor is likely to be a common ancestor for the offender. And then now it's a matter of identifying the descendants of that common ancestor down into the era in which we feel our offender was born. And for the Golden State Killer, that was between the years of 1940 and 1960. So that, in a nutshell, is how that worked.
Very interesting. We're talking to Paul Holes, who is the lead investigator in apprehending the Golden State Killer. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Show. We're talking to Paul Holes, who's the lead investigator in the Golden State Killer crimes, which was solved this week with the arrest of John Joseph D'Angelo. And that was a tape recording, I believe, of one of the calls that a victim received. Is that right, Paul?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, that victim had been attacked in June of 1976. And the Golden State Killer called her January of 1978. So 18 months later, he's coming back to terrorize her with that phone call.
Just really, just chilling. Now, all the years that you've worked on this case and all the people that you've looked at, and I know there were other persons of interest over the years, is there anything about D'Angelo that surprises you or that you find consistent with what you thought about who the perpetrator was going to be?
Well, there's a lot that surprises me, and I think first and foremost that he was a full-time law enforcement officer for the entirety of the Northern California attacks. And when you look at his geographic distribution of his attacks, they covered from Sacramento all the way down to the South Bay, down to San Jose. That's a driving distance of close to almost 110 miles. Yet he's working full-time for a police department while he's going out and committing these attacks. I never thought that that would be the case. I always thought that he would be based in Sacramento, and his job was going to take him to these other jurisdictions. There's still a lot that we need to know about him, and maybe he was moonlighting. I felt that the Golden State Killer was somehow involved in construction, and D'Angelo, in his military background, had received training as a carpenter, so maybe he's going around helping frame houses, but we're still trying to figure that out.
Now, there was
not surprising.
Go ahead.
Now, I was just going to say, it's not very surprising, though, in many ways that he had law enforcement training, because the Golden State Killer demonstrated that he was very tactically sound. He knew how to approach a house and leave a house without people seeing him. He was able to take control of entire families inside a house and limit the risk to himself. He was all about self-preservation. And many people over the years have thought, well, he might be a cop. And I kind of attributed it to, well, he's a smart guy, and a smart guy is going to try to protect himself. But it turns out, you know, it looks like he absolutely did have law enforcement training, and he used that to his advantage to commit his attacks.
I may be generalizing just a bit, but rapist, if you look at profiles of rapists, like this type of serial rapist, a lot of them live sort of normal lives. They're not necessarily people from underprivileged backgrounds. They, you know, have maybe be successful somewhat in their businesses. Some of them are married, and they live a normal life, and it's surprising to even the people around them that they are doing this kind of horrible activity. Do you think, just obviously you don't know the answer, but do you think that others around him knew that he was the Golden State Killer?
Well, they didn't know he was a Golden State Killer. You know, he put on a facade of having a normal life. He was married. He had children. He had a stable job. He lived in a solid middle-class neighborhood. He took good care of the yard and his house from the outside. However, the neighbors are now reporting that he was a little bit strange, and he was confrontational. He seemed to be verbally abusive at times. So there was a personality deficit that would be consistent with our offender. But you can't, you know, take that and extrapolate to this guy being the Golden State Killer just on that.
Of course. There was a little interesting fact that I recall. One perpetrator, at least one, recalled the perpetrator saying words to the effect, "I hate you, Bonnie." And we understand that D'Angelo had a fiance named Bonnie. Does this add anything to the mix as far as you're concerned about whether or not he's guilty and how that might be used at trial?
I'm not sure exactly how that would be used at trial. You know, that was a characteristic of our offender that we knew. In an attack in July of 1978, as he's in the physical act of sexually assaulting that victim, he is saying, I hate you, Bonnie, over and over again while he's sobbing. So we've always felt that our offender had a Bonnie in his life that was significant, either a mother, a wife, ex-wife, girlfriend, ex-girlfriend. And so when D'Angelo kind of bubbled to the surface, and we ran across that article of an engagement to a Bonnie, that caught our attention. And the fact that we never could find that they married indicated that that relationship likely went bad. And now the thought is that whatever memory Bonnie had, that D'Angelo had of Bonnie, that was bubbling to the surface while he's sexually assaulting that one victim. Now, doesn't mean he's guilty of these crimes, but it most certainly was a criteria that we often looked for when we were evaluating suspects.
For some of my listeners, they know that I represented a local notorious serial killer in his last set of death row appeals. And in his case, his crimes escalated at the end, and it was almost as if he wanted to get caught. And he was extremely stressed out, and he was killing it sometimes three boys in one evening. But in this case, it's unusual because the crime stopped, and then for 5 years there was no crime, and then there was one final crime, and then nothing. What do you make of that? Did he stop committing crimes? Was he doing it somewhere else? And could he stop this compulsion? Was he able to do that?
Well, when I've looked at this series and when I've evaluated this offender, you know, he is most similar to another known offender known as BTK, Dennis Rader. And Dennis Rader stopped his crimes. He was a meticulous planner, just like the Golden State Killer. Dennis Rader went inside a house and was expecting only a single female, and then ended up being confronted by a male and getting into a physical fight. Dennis Rader, during his confessions, basically said, "I left that attack location thinking I could have been hurt, I could have been killed, I could have been caught. I don't want any of that to occur." So I decided at that point to stop. And he was also getting older and realized his physical capabilities were diminishing. In 1981, the Golden State Killer is confronted face-to-face by 6'3" Gregory Sanchez. He gets into a physical fight with him. He ends up killing Gregory Sanchez. But in my opinion, Sanchez scared him. He walked away from that attack thinking, I could have been hurt, I could have been killed, I could have been caught, just like Dennis Rader. We don't have any known attacks until he runs across beautiful 19-year-old Janelle Cruz in May of 1986. And I just think he saw her. He couldn't help himself. There was no men present, which is an aberration for him at this stage in his attacks. And he went ahead and killed Janelle. It's possible there's other attacks after Janelle Cruz. However, we have looked, and we have failed to find anything. So I think he parallels Dennis Rader. He's an aging offender. He was 41 at the time of Janelle Cruz, and he did not want to get caught.
I've got one last question for you, and this is a pretend question. Let's pretend that you and Mr. John Joseph D'Angelo have 1 hour together in a jail cell, and let's just pretend that he's going to be forthcoming with you and he's going to answer the questions that you ask him. What are you going to ask him? What are you going to say to this guy who you've been chasing for 24 years?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's so much that I want to know about him. You know, many people want to know what is in his psychology to drive him to commit these crimes. I'm not so much interested in that. I'm interested in the tactics that he employed. How did he know some of the intelligence? He was very good at gathering intelligence on his victims and timing his attacks when some of these victims could only be attacked. I kind of want to know the tactics and strategies, his thought process, so I can then take that and learn from it to be able to apply it to other cases.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us. I know you've been busy, and I want to say I've been watching you on television, and I think your career is just ahead of you. I can see you on, what is that, ID, whatever, and I see you doing a cold case show. I do. I see that in your near future.
Well, I hope something like that worked out.
Thank you for joining me. Paul Holes, the lead investigator for the Golden State Killer.